I had never in my kind of in-house W-2 career tried to grow a big team or even really have many direct reports. So it would have been a new thing for me to do to go and try to build a bigger team as a consultant. So it did feel pretty natural. And then everybody would ask me, oh, are you starting an agency? Are you hiring people? Are you doing this? And I had to go through a little bit of a moment where I was like, is that what I'm supposed to do? Am I supposed to be hiring these people? And was able to come out the other side of that and realize I'm quite happy as a soloist.
Hello, hello. Welcome to the Soloist Life podcast, formerly known as Soloist Women, where we're all about turning your expertise into wealth and impact. I'm Rochelle Moulton, and today I'm here with Jackie Miller, who's a communications pro with over 15 years of experience in early stage and high complexity businesses. Previously, she led communications at PillPack, a digital pharmacy, from the first customer through its $1 billion acquisition by Amazon. She's also launched Moonshots at Google X and helped bring to market the first genomic tumor test for personalized cancer treatment at Foundation Medicine. Today, she works alongside founding teams to take the long view on communications as an executive function. Her philosophy is that the best PR strategy is ultimately just running a thoughtful business. Jackie, welcome.
Thank you so much, Rochelle. I'm really happy to be here.
Oh, I'm so excited. So one of the many reasons I invited you on the show is your powerhouse year number one experience as a soloist. So why don't we start there? Maybe you could tell us about how you decided to leave your job and to go solo. Like, how hard was it to exit and make that transition to owning your own business?
Absolutely. So I do also have to say, Rochelle, I found your podcast early on, and it has been so helpful to hear other folks who've made this jump. So it is really an honor to be here to share my story too. So I had a job, a full-time job, and you know, I'd been in the role for probably 6 months, and I was starting to feel like this is not my genius zone. This is just not accessing the parts of my brain that I want. I don't think it's the right fit. So I had started thinking, you know, what would it look like if I left? What would I do? I don't know, kind of poking around. And also feeling quite a bit of fear because I'd been there for just a short amount of time and obviously didn't want to, you know, kind of burn any bridges. And all of this was rolling around in my head. And then in the background also had, as you'd mentioned in the intro, you know, I'd worked for a startup, had kind of a nest egg from that acquisition. So I knew I would be okay if it took me a minute to figure out the next thing. And one day I grew really frustrated. Something happened at work and I kind of had an out of body moment where I was like, you know, there's not that many opportunities in life where you get to make a decision based on your gut feeling and what you know is right for you. And this is not right for me. And I'm going to leave and I'm going to figure out what the next best thing looks like for me. And so pretty rapidly, I closed up shop there and left everything in good shape. And the first thing I did, Rochelle, was I went and I got a new headshot.
And it's funny because that's the thing that everybody hates. Like, they leave it to the very end. I love it.
And as a communications and public relations person, I was like, you know what I think is going to make me feel confident about whatever I do next? It's having a brand new headshot on LinkedIn. So that Saturday after my last day at work, I went and you know, I got my makeup done and got a new headshot. And I kind of just hung my shingle out in the proverbial sense on LinkedIn and started trying to figure it out.
So you didn't do the, oh, let me create this giant website and figure out the 2,700 things I can do for you. You started on LinkedIn.
I did. I'm trying to think exactly what I did. I switched my role to working for myself. I was fortunate enough to have a couple of folks very early on who, you know, I'd sort of been talking to, and they were like, if you become free, we have work for you to do. So I was fortunate enough to have that early on while I wrote my website and that sort of thing. And yeah, I just really started kind of putting it out there to folks in my network that I was available to do projects and would love to chat.
Okay. So, you know, I always ask people, you know, how long did it take to make your first 100,000? And I know that you made over 100,000 in your first year. So tell us how you experienced like the financial side of your new business, especially compared to yourself as a salaried employee.
Yeah, it's been wild. The pricing side was really intimidating to me at first. As an in-house person, I'd worked with agencies. I'd worked with a few soloists. I understood the value of what I could do. But putting together those early proposals, I was lucky to have a few friends who'd kind of been here before me who were willing to look at them, but it was very overwhelming. But what I quickly figured out was when I'm doing my best work, it's very valuable to the companies. And in a full-time role at the level that I'd gotten to as a communications professional, I hadn't been in a job for a while that was using kind of my full brain all of the time. Mm. So initially I was like, oh, is it okay to make this much money in a month? Am I overcharging? What am I doing? But I realized that the pricing structure as a soloist at a certain point in your career is really lucrative and fun because you're doing the things that, you know, at least for me, that I find both the most challenging, but also the most rewarding, but that are also creating the most value for the folks I'm working with.
And it's funny that that would be a disconnect, right? Like I'm doing these things in my genius zone. They're worth a lot of money. Oh, I can charge a lot.
Right. I'm like, and I'm making three times as much as I was as a W-2 employee. Is that right? And when you think about it logically, it makes sense. But it was a strange realization for me. And then really exciting about what that meant for my earning potential and what kind of a lifestyle I could figure out while still having so much fun.
Well, and I just want to point out that, mindset is so critical. Right. And you just set a magic number, at least in my head, which is three times. So you got to a point where you were earning three times what you earned as an employee, using your full brain, doing what you love. Were you working as much as an employee, more or about the same?
I will say I was working quite a bit more. Mm-hmm. Still, I would say in my, the first year, probably the biggest thing I need to still figure out is how to get to the number of hours I want to be working a week. I'm not working. I have two small children, so they don't really allow me to work much more than maybe 35 or 40 hours. But I'd like to get to the point where I can just balance that a little bit better. So definitely working more, but I think also just feeling much more fulfilled by it.
Yes. It feels like a holistic approach to it.
Absolutely. And just really excited to open my email and see what new things had come in and tackle the next project. I was just feeling energized in a way that I hadn't in quite a bit.
Yeah, what a difference that is to be excited about the emails coming into your box. Right. So when we first met, you'd already made the decision to niche, which in my experience is boldly unusual. Lots of folks spend that freshman year doing a little bit of everything and then regretting it in year two. But you focused like right from the beginning. Like, tell us about that decision and how it played out, where you decided to play in a specific niche.
Yeah, it started out in part based on other communications professionals that I'd seen going off on their own. And the ones that I was most inspired by, I felt like were being quite specific about what they were doing. Communications is a really broad field. It can fit into marketing. It can fit separate from marketing. It can be just public relations. It can be just internal communications. It's a very broad area of expertise. And as I kind of looked around at other folks who were doing this, soloist thing or building small agencies, I was really inspired by the people who were saying, quite specifically, we are doing this thing for this industry in this way. So I wanted to get to that as quickly as possible. And I also, having been in-house and running these functions inside of businesses for so long, I really had a good understanding of what makes for a good soloist consultant offering in terms of what sort of things you can have somebody like that take on successfully. So those two experiences helped me feel more confident in offering a tighter range of services when I first started.
Well, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but as I'm listening to you, it sounds like you've got a point of view, whether you've fully articulated in writing or not. Is that the case?
Yes.
You have a point of view in terms of communications, in terms of how it impacts clients, the way that it works best.
Definitely. I would say I'm very passionate about the idea that communications cannot be fully outsourced, nor should it be. I actually, as I've gotten further into this first year of business, I've niched even more than I think the first time we talked, and into really thinking about engagements as working with very, very early stage companies who, it's still the founder and a small team. And then there's kind of this valley where I think a lot of companies and startups, especially, who is the majority of folks I work with are venture-backed startups, where they kind of try to fake it for a while on the communication side. And they don't quite want to hire the expertise. So they're trying to fill the gaps with somebody in marketing or a PR agency. I get really passionate about talking to those folks and telling them, just go hire someone who loves to write and has high judgment. and bring them in-house and let them work with you and trust them and give them the tools they need to really guide the business. Like we live in a world where reputation is everything. And that person doesn't need to be super senior, but you do need someone who's looking out for the reputation of the business. So it's a little ironic that that's my strong point of view because then I'm here as a consultant. But I think having that point of view helps me give clients really good advice. And then I can tell them, they're like, okay, great. So what can you do for us? And then I can talk about kind of the range of things that I can do either before you hire that person to set them up for success or after you've hired them to be a thought partner and a coach and an extra set of hands when they need it, but you know, mostly helping them figure out how to grow that role within the business.
Well, one of the advantages of taking that position is that you're doing two things at the same time. One is you're telling them to essentially get a trusted advisor that they hire to keep on staff. And the other is by saying the opposite of what many other people would say in order to get work, you have built more trust in that initial engagement.
Yes.
So yeah, that makes perfect sense to me.
Yep.
So moving forward though, like what do you see as the revenue potential from this for this business from where you are now? So where you are now, three times what you were making as an employee, are you picturing that you can double your revenue, triple, you know, a much bigger multiplier? Where do you see it, the business going?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. And I'm influenced by people you've had on the podcast before, and I'll name drop them because people should go listen to their episodes. But I remember Erica Goody's episode, you talked to Heather Welpley and Katie Burkhart, and they all had these amazing points about how they make their business and their financial goals really work for their lives as a whole. And that's the thing I think I'm trying to figure out. And I don't know yet what that looks like for me. I think I'd love to kind of toggle the pricing levers and the services levers and then what other things are important in my life to figure that out. But it has been a lot of fun, I think, in year one to just really go for it and see what I can do if I'm firing on all cylinders.
And it's a little unfair of me to ask you that question at the end of year one, right? But sometimes you just see a clear path ahead. Well, do you see adding employees at some point or have you become a confirmed soloist?
I'm pretty sure I'm a confirmed soloist. I just don't get as much enjoyment out of managing people. And I've got a couple proposals out right now where I've brought in colleagues or peers who do similar things and proposing, you know, we can work together to do all of the things that you need. But it's really fun to only report to myself.
Yeah.
And for me, I think it helps me be more in my genius zone more often when I'm not also trying to delegate and figure out who's going to do what. And I get to focus on the projects that I feel like are best fit for my expertise.
I'm just curious, when you first left the corporate environment, did you know that at the beginning? Because sometimes people will say, oh yeah, I was in corporate and I was managing a bunch of employees and I just realized it just wasn't for me. Or is this something that kind of grew on you gradually as you figured out your genius zone?
I've always known that I really enjoy being an executive level individual contributor. And I think that's kind of a rarefied position. And I was very fortunate to be able to do that for quite some time where I didn't have a team and manage people. And I got to sit at the table and have my thoughts and go and do my work. And I really liked that. So I had never in my kind of in-house, you know, W-2 career tried to grow a big team or even really have many direct reports. So it would have been a new thing for me to do to go and try to build a bigger team as a consultant. So it did feel pretty natural. And then everybody would ask me, oh, are you starting an agency? Are you hiring people? Are you doing this? And I had to go through a little bit of a moment where I was like, is that what I'm supposed to do? Am I supposed to be hiring these people? And was able to come out the other side of that and realize I'm quite happy as a soloist.
You know, I'm so glad to hear you say that because so many of us went through that process where the outside world is so used to this idea that being an entrepreneur means you're going to hire people and you're not successful until you hire people. So yeah, it's great that you not only resisted that, but figured out what would work for you.
Yeah. And it's been fun to get to know other people who have kind of adjacent skill sets, because when I meet with a client and I might, or potential client, and I might like them, I might think it's an interesting business, but it just isn't quite the right fit for me. It's also really rewarding to be able to say, you know, this isn't quite right for me, but I've got three peers over here that I'm happy to introduce you to, and it's more in their wheelhouse. And so I don't know, I really enjoy that. And I think it's a fun way to build relationships without having to build a company or build, I guess, a business with employees.
Well, and it's also fun just to work with other people that are at your level. Like, they have different skill sets, and sometimes it's fun to work with other people versus always doing it solo.
Totally.
Without the responsibility of employment.
Yes.
So, Jackie, how do you think about and make decisions about who you'll work with and which projects you'll take on? Like you just said, oh, yeah, if I feel like somebody's not quite the right fit, I might pass them on. How do you decide?
It's gotten easier as I defined my niches even more tightly. And I would say it's two things. The first thing is it's a vibe. I think probably one of my superpowers is I don't mind Zooms. You know, I think a lot of people were like, you know, at the end of the pandemic, we're like, I never want to get on a Zoom again. I find it relatively easy to connect with people even over a Zoom. And I can tell pretty quickly if we're going to work together well or not. And so as I've, you know, been able to trust myself more about those judgments, it's been easier to figure out, you know, yeah, I think this is going to be a great relationship. We should go forward with it. Or, you know, maybe this is going to be more of a grind than either of us would want it to be. So there's that. There's the vibe part of it. And then getting better at asking the right questions to figure out what the potential client actually needs. Again, I think like communications and public relations can be so squishy for people that oftentimes clients are coming to me not quite knowing what they need. So being able to ask specific questions and get to the heart of their business goals and how the things that I do can intersect with their business goals faster and with more precision is something that has definitely gotten easier over the course of the last year and hopefully will get continuously easier.
Yeah. See, I think of those as consulting skills.
Yep.
The presenting problem is almost never the problem that you wind up actually solving. So it's right. All the skill sets the questioning skill sets that take you through that process where you get to apply your expertise, but in all these different situations.
Yes. And honestly, a lot of the time, the problem that people come to me with is that they think they need to issue a press release. And it's very rare that that's actually the thing that they need to do or the problem that they're having. So I do a lot of conversations around figuring out why do we think that the press release is the thing we need to do? Can we work back into what problems we're trying to solve in the business and where communications might help?
Perfect example. I love that. Well, when we were going back and forth, you said that no one interviews you to be your own boss. And so I'd like you to talk some more about that for anybody listening who is trying to decide whether the soloist entrepreneurial path is for them.
Yeah, I mean, I talked about this, but I kind of jumped into it without interviewing myself or really having that much foresight into it. But I do think I have some things that have now occurred to me about why this has been so much fun and such a good fit for me that in retrospect, I would have asked myself ahead of time. You know, I think part of it is thinking, would you hire you? What are the things that you would hire you for? And that has really helped me define some of these niches is thinking about like, okay, if I was on the other side of this, what would I hire me for? What are the things that are kind of my unique skill sets in terms of the places I've worked, the people I know, my kind of perspective on communications and public relations, and, you know, working through those things to figure out, is this soloist life going to be a good fit for me? So, you know, for me, it's like I've worked in a number of different industries. I've worked with a lot of people. So even when I first started, and I didn't realize this at the time, but I had a really large network of people who actually had a really deep knowledge of my work. So I think it's easy to have a long career and have done a lot of things very successfully, but not have that many people who have actually worked with you closely. But because of the nature of what I do, there's so many people who I've worked with in the past who were then eager to say like, great, this is amazing. I'd love to work with you again. So that was an advantage that I had. Thinking about if you enjoy kind of the full spectrum of the work, like some people I think are very energized by seeing the end product and they're really good managers of people and really good at bringing a team together to help them get to that end goal. And some people are really energized by actually doing the work piece by piece. And I think I have a hunch, maybe you know, I don't know, but being a soloist, you sort of have to find both the process and the end result to be rewarding and enjoyable because you are doing quite a bit of all of that work. And you want to make sure that you can maintain the energy over the course of projects and engagements. So that turns out that was a really big advantage that I had that I would have perhaps asked me at the beginning if it was true.
Yeah, it's kind of like, how do you get your jollies, right? Do you get them from seeing the completed project? Do you get it from the process? And even if it's from the process, is it from the things that you're adding to it? Or is it how you choose and assemble and run the team? And those are very different things when you're consulting.
Yes, totally. The former is definitely me. And I've talked to lots of folks since I started this who I can't imagine doing that. I'm like, of course not, because it's your skill set is just in this other kind of way of working where this wouldn't be a good fit for you at all. So I think, yeah, those are kind of some of the things that I, in retrospect, might have asked myself before jumping into this adventure.
Well, although if you were the kind of person who likes to put everything together, you might start an agency, right? You probably wouldn't do a solo, but you could, you might still say, yeah, I want to do this, but I just want to do it in a different way. And I resonate with that because that's how I made my first jump.
Yep.
Because I like to do all of the pieces and have a bunch of people working together. So I built a firm.
Yep.
Yeah. It's figuring out if you're ready for the entrepreneurial life.
Yeah. The last thing, I think we touched on this earlier, but I think having an opinion about the work that you do and the way that it's best done is very helpful in terms of just selling and differentiating yourself. Like, people don't have to agree with you, but if you have an opinion and something you can get kind of worked up about when you're talking about why you approach things the way you do, I think it helps people remember who you are. It helps them decide if it's going to be a good fit. And it just makes those conversations more fun.
Oh, absolutely. And if you've got that and it's different from what everybody else is saying, even if it's just different in one or two smaller ways, it makes a difference. It makes an impact and it's more memorable.
Yep. It surprises people and people remember when they're surprised.
Yeah. Well, the other point you raised, I thought was really interesting. And you said that you thought some of us, and especially women, perhaps people of color, may hit certain inflection points in our careers, whether it's due to bias or caregiving responsibilities, where we're just not practicing. I love the expression you used, at the top of our license. And so what do you see as the solution to that? I mean, I know what yours was, right? You left and started your own firm and so that you can practice at the top of your game. But what do you see as people's options and solutions for this?
Yeah, my experience in healthcare is showing that's a phrase that often gets used for healthcare practitioners when they're not able to practice at the top of their license because they have too much admin work or other things to do. And I love it. I think it resonates with a lot of people, as you mentioned, where just you kind of got to create your own opportunities. And it can be really difficult, I think, even if you're in a great workplace, to be able to get the work that you really want to be doing. And one of my favorite things I do as part of kind of one of my niches is I work with whoever is the most senior communications or public relations or marketing leader in a business, and as kind of a thought partner and a coach. And we do a lot of conversations in those engagements talking about how do you kind of go to your executive team or, the management team, whoever it might be, and help them understand what you can do if you're given the space to do it. And how do you talk them through that and get them to kind of look at your role in a different way? And I think a lot of roles, especially communications and PR, that are kind of more seen as more softer skills, there is both a challenge and an opportunity to help kind of traditional executive types understand exactly what those functions can do for the business if given the space.
And, it's interesting when you said that is I never think of PR as a soft skill.
Thank you.
Just the opposite.
Thank you.
when you've worked with a really top-notch PR person, you will never, ever think of it as a soft skill again.
I think that's true. And I certainly have a number of folks who, I've worked with in the past and are good friends who text me when they're in a sticky situation. And I think they would agree that it is not a soft skill at all.
No. So, Jackie, I would just be remiss if I didn't try to pick your brain a little bit for our listeners. So you're a communications and PR expert, obviously operating at the top of your game. What kinds of advice do you have for soloists in the B2B expertise space?
I have been shocked, and this is not a plug for the platform, but I have been shocked by how effective LinkedIn is these days in terms of finding people and connecting with people. And so I really do encourage people to take the time to think through what kinds of opinions do they have? Are there basics about what you do that other folks might not understand that you can go and share? occasionally are there funny things that you could share. But I do think being kind of active in that space, which is really functioning these days as the water cooler for business writ large, who knows what platform will take its place in the future. But right now, I do find that that is just very effective to be on there and just engaging and being authentic and figuring out what you care about. I don't think there are a lot of shortcuts to that. You know, I think people sometimes are looking for, you know, is there a way I can automate this? Can I outsource this?
What's the hack?
What's the hack to doing this? It seems hard. And I don't know if there is one other than putting some real thought into kind of, you know, sometimes I tell people, you know, what are three opinions that you hold strongly? And can we write about those in 15 different ways? And I think that as you start to figure out those strongly held opinions, it gets a lot easier to participate in the conversations.
That's kind of how I think of it as the point of view, right?
Yep.
Those opinions are buried inside that view. I love that approach. And I assume you're going to tell us we don't need press releases.
There's a purpose for press releases. If you have a new business and you need the name to pop up in Google when people search for it, a press release is a great way to make sure that that's going to happen. You know, if there are things that journalists are searching for, like if you're going to present at a conference or, you know, I work in the healthcare space, if you've gotten, you know, an FDA approval or some other kind of approval that people are looking for that kind of information, press releases can be really useful. So I wouldn't say like never do a press release. But I do think in general, the way that people use media and should use media in terms of publicity is changing in no small part because I'm terrible, but media rooms are shrinking. Like the staff on publications has just been decimated in the last year. It's not great for society. And it does make public relations more challenging because there just aren't as many reporters covering the spaces. So you need to send them really good pitches because they're getting a whole lot of them. And I think if you do want to be kind of a person who shows up in press and shows up in media, it's just like building any other kind of relationship. It's about figuring out who is covering the space that you're interested in, really reading the things that they're writing, you know, buy a subscription to the outlet, pay for it if you want to be featured in it. I think that's a big one. Like people be like,
I know this is so basic and it just doesn't occur to everybody.
Nope, it doesn't. So, you know, really reading the publications where you hope to be featured. And then again, like it gets back to your point of view and figuring out ways to share that and opportunities that make sense. You know, when you're being, you know, if someone is writing an article and you have a strong reaction to it, either positive or negative, like let them know. Reporters are people too. So I encourage people to not look at the media as necessarily being gatekept by public relations agencies and things like that, and that they are people with whom you can form a relationship just like anybody else.
Yes. I've had so much success with relationships with media because I just think people think they're not real people.
No, they're people who are trying to learn about the world. And if you can offer them useful information that's not self-serving, that helps them see the world in a new way, they're going to be really grateful.
Well, it's the nature of a journalist, right? Is they're nosing around trying to find something that nobody else has figured out yet. And I think part of the key too, in addition to treating them like real people, is that they are very, very busy real people. Probably the busiest people in your circle.
Extremely busy. So really respecting that. And I think there is a meta point there about kind of information and disinformation. And if you're going to try to engage with press, really respecting the job that they're doing and the role that they have kind of in society to try to be arbiters of what is true and figuring out what's true and what's not true and presenting facts to people. And I think having a deep respect for that role and how difficult it is really critical to building those relationships.
Yeah, I'm just going to throw this in there. So when I started my first business, we hired a PR person after about the first year. And she said, you know, what would you like to have happen? And I said, well, I'd like to be in the Wall Street Journal. And she managed to get it. And I prepped for that interview for 2 days. I have never been grilled like that up to that point. And I'd done a lot of media, never been grilled like that. This woman was amazing. She was so smart. She did all of her homework. She had all the non-obvious questions. And I remembered thinking, yes, I will never not prepare like a fiend for an interview with big media. So
I have so much, obviously, it's why I do this job, but I have so much respect for journalism and especially the big publications. The folks who work there and do that reporting are so smart about so many different industries. But I think also they have so much to know that they are quite grateful and open to somebody coming to them with a niche area of expertise who can help explain something that might be complicated or not obvious to somebody outside the space looking in.
Totally. So, you know, because I know you listen to these episodes, that there is a question I like to ask everybody, which is if you could go back to who you were when you first started your business, which this time is not very long ago, right? What's the one thing you'd advise her to do?
Yes, I have thought about this. I think it is probably, and people have said this before, but it's just so true, like trusting my gut on decisions. You know, the couple of engagements and client engagements I've had that have been less successful, I knew from the beginning that it wasn't going to be a good fit. And I didn't quite listen to myself. And I, you know, or I was looking at the numbers for the month and I said, you know, okay, let's do this. And I've definitely, those were learning experiences. And looking back, it's like, nope, when you have a gut feeling that this isn't going to be a great engagement, just pass it on along. The good ones will be coming and they'll come faster if you are making space for them.
Love that mindset, that point of view. So Jackie, we're going to be putting all sorts of links to you and your content in the show notes, but where's the best place for people to learn more about you and your work?
They can come find me on LinkedIn. I am Jackie Miller or Jacqueline Miller. You can link it in the show notes, but that is probably the place I am most active these days.
Awesome. Jackie, thank you so much. I just love the story of your freshman year and going into a sophomore year that sounds like it's going to be every bit as successful as the first year. So thank you for sharing your story and your advice. I so appreciate you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for inviting me on. And true thank you to all your previous guests who have really been inspiring on my journey through this first year.
Love that. Okay, that's it for this episode. I hope you'll join us next time for The Soloist Life. Bye-bye.